Hello, I'm Richard Feidler. Thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are plenty more conversations about things you're interested in and things you don't know you're interested in yet. Not until you try them anyway. Go to abc.net.au/conversations or to iTunes, where you can get lots more for free.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Around about 35 years ago, the chief of a major US drug company did an interview. He was close to retirement, and the man was reflecting on the very successful sales record of his company, which was Merck Pharmaceuticals. But he said he was disappointed about one thing. He said it was a shame that Merck's market had been limited to sick people. He said it had long been his dream to make drugs for healthy people too. He wanted everyone to have the benefit of his pharmaceuticals, and that's got to be a good thing, right? Well, my guest today believes that dream has come true for the drug companies. His name is Ray Moynihan. Ray is a journalist who focuses on health issues. His work has been published in major newspapers, as well as the British Medical Journal and The Lancet. Ray Moynihan says that drug companies are using fear to sell drugs to people who don't need them. And more than that, they're funding research that appears to be independent into the conditions that their drugs are marketed to treat. Ray says that aggressive marketing campaigns are turning common complaints into frightening disorders, that shy people receive treatment for social anxiety disorder, overactive kids, too many of them, are treated for ADHD, and now he says that drug companies are urging women who lack a strong sexual appetite to accept that they may be suffering from female sexual dysfunction. And there's a pill on the way for that too. Ray Moynihan is the author, a co-author of several books. One is called Selling Sickness, and his new one is called Sex, Lies and Pharmaceuticals. Hello, Ray.
Hello, Richard. Thank you.
Well, you started as an investigative journalist at Four Corners, didn't you, pretty much?
Yeah, that was one of the early jobs that I had, and what a place to train. If you're going to train as an investigative journalist, it's one of the best places in the world. I was there for 5 years in the early 90s, had a lot of fun, did a lot of very hard work. I remember a lot of 100-hour weeks, but yeah, great place.
It struck me that there's been very little media focus on health issues in general. I mean, we focus on politics, and that's important. Politicians are held in much lower public esteem than doctors and health practitioners are, and maybe that's why. I wonder what got you interested in reporting on health issues to begin with.
Well, excuse me. I mean, I'm very interested in the way power works, and the medical profession and the industries within the medical businesses are very powerful businesses. Often we don't see that commercial power. It's sort of hidden. It's behind the scenes. So I was very interested. But at Four Corners, we did a story on ADHD, and I got to say, I was utterly shocked by the way some of the doctors behaved. And that was really the beginning of an epidemic of over-diagnosing kids.
What did you see, Ray?
What we saw, we were sitting in a doctor's surgery, very much like this room we're sitting in now, Richard, and it was a small room. A family came in, a mother and two little kids. One of the kids was already diagnosed. She'd brought in her three-year-old to be assessed, and the doctor diagnosed the toddler with ADD and recommended possible treatment with drugs.
What kind of behaviour could you see that toddler
To me, the exhibiting? Toddler looked perfectly normal and perfectly reasonable. It was three or four. Let's say it was three or four, but I think it was three. And the doctor duly diagnosed the child with this condition. The family walked out of the surgery. The doctor then turned to us and said, well, actually, that was a bit of a borderline case. I'm not really sure whether that kid had ADD or not, but I did it anyway, because clearly it was, you know, it was that thing of maybe that it was what the parent wanted anyway. It was an extraordinary thing. The anger from that first-hand experience of overdiagnosis really started to fuel a growing interest in the business of medicine, and that's where we are today.
You did a story for the 7:30 report on back pain. Tell me about the nature of that story too,
Ray. Well, what I discovered then, this was in the mid-90s, and there was this growing movement called evidence-based medicine, which was starting to say, look, guys, we've got to look at the evidence. We can't just keep doing all these procedures and prescribing all these pills, doing all these tests, unless we've got good evidence. Now, one of the examples...
So I just assumed that that was happening anyway.
We all assume that, Richard, and unfortunately it's a wrong assumption. There are many procedures today that have not been properly, rigorously tested. Our drugs are more and more tested, but procedures, spinal surgery was an example back then, and that was the example in the mid-90s, was spinal surgery for back pain. Had never been properly tested, had never been properly trialled, and yet was being widely used. Another one today is this thing called vertebroplasty. I don't know if many people have heard of it, but it's a process where they inject cement into your vertebra in your back to try and prevent or cure fractures. Has not been properly trialled in good quality trials until very, very recently, widely used before it was proven, and some critics argue that it's just too dangerous and not well proven enough to be on the market.
But these things need to be trialled before you can look at research, don't they? I mean, you can't sort of say...
Don't do it until they're proven.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely right. And that is the point, that when a new procedure comes along, it should be tested properly before it's widely used. And unfortunately, that is still not the case.
Let me just, to begin with, when your central idea, tell me if I've got this right, you're saying that many of the drugs that you mention in your books actually do help some people.
Correct.
It's just that the so-called patient pool now is way too big. It just includes way too many healthy people. So the drugs you're talking about most of the time, nearly all of the time, do help some people, just not required for the larger group prescribed.
That's absolutely right, Richard. Almost all the drugs we're talking about, drugs for depression, drugs for high blood pressure, drugs for osteoporosis, drugs for high cholesterol, sexual dysfunction even, possibly, these drugs do work for a certain cohort of people, and for them they may well be entirely appropriate. But when you add in the tsunami of marketing that has been pushed in this country, mainly at the medical profession, and there's a whole lot of other factors as well that we might talk about through the hour, you end up with a situation where people who do not need to be medicated are receiving drug therapy at enormous cost to the national taxpayers' bill, and at a personal cost to those people because they are experiencing the side effects of drugs that they did not need and they could never benefit from.
Pharmaceutical corporations are like any corporations. They want to return value to shareholder and they'll try to increase market share. Have you seen any PR documents that talk about widening the so-called patient pool?
Yes. Look, luckily, as a journalist, it's one of the joys of journalism, as you'd probably know too. Occasionally, people drop documents off in brown paper bags, and that's happened to me off and on over the years. And one of them was for a condition called irritable bowel syndrome. Now, again, there's a certain cohort of people, a certain proportion of people for whom that is a very serious condition. But there was an attempt several years ago by the drug companies that were making drugs for this condition to widen the boundaries, widen the definitions, and they were trying to claim that one in five people suffered from irritable bowel syndrome, and we saw the marketing documents that a PR company was using, that a drug company had, a drug company was working with a PR company. This is in Australia, and the message was to get doctors to start believing that this was a widespread severe disease that needed to be widely treated. Now, the problem there was that the drug was much more dangerous than the condition. And the drug, in fact, was pulled from the market ultimately because it was a number of people died after taking it. So there was an example where the drug therapy was not particularly valuable for many people at all.
In the United States, my understanding is that drug manufacturers can directly market specific products through advertising.
To the public.
To the public. That's a freedom of speech thing, I think. I think it's probably the constitutional guarantee. It's not the case here. You can't add, you can instead have all sorts of other ways of doing it. So you say that the key thing then is direct marketing, if you like, to doctors. And you call this a form of corruption that takes place in fine restaurants all around Australia. What's the nature of that corruption?
Well, Richard, if you've got a visitor friend, if any of your listeners have a friend coming from overseas and they want to visit Perth or Sydney or Melbourne or Darwin or Brisbane or Mount Isa, and they want to find out where the best restaurants are, then what you should do is you should go to the pharmaceutical industry's website, because they actually list all of the restaurants where they take doctors to dinner every week. And it is a fine dining guide to Australia. Every night of the week, across Australia, drug companies are funding lavish meals for your GP, for my GP, for our specialists. There's no other word for it. It's a form of corruption. There are regulations that are changing. There's increasing disquiet about this.
Maybe not my GP. I might just put that in there. I don't know that, so I'm sure it probably isn't the case.
You can check next time.
Let me clear. Okay. All right. So that's not just medical researchers. That's not just surgeons.
Practicing physicians, practicing doctors, practicing specialists. In my part of the world, I live in Byron Bay, I've discovered that the local psychiatrists are taken to a restaurant called Satiate, one of Australia's most amazing restaurants in the town called Bangalore. And what I've just done is reveal some details that I was going to use in a forthcoming story. But nevertheless, this is where the psychiatrists are, I understand, regularly wined and dined with drug company money.
Part of me think, you know, I suppose someone listening to this or some doctors listening to this might think, well, what's the big deal? I mean, does taking a doctor out to lunch make them suddenly brainwashed into prescribing a company's pharmaceuticals?
Well, there is evidence on that very question that you ask. And no, if you take one doctor out to one meal, unlikely to change that person's practice. You take doctors out collectively over many, many weeks, months, years, decades, generations, you end up with a picture of extraordinary drug company influence over prescribing habits. And indeed, there are actual studies that have looked at this question. Overwhelmingly, the result of those studies is that if you expose doctors to marketing activities like free meals, trips away, those marketing activities have an impact. They tend to prescribe newer and more expensive medicines as a result. Sometimes that's good for their patients, sometimes it's not.
Where does this duchessing process begin with doctors?
It begins when they're medical students. I had friends of mine. I grew up in Brisbane. I went to the University of Queensland. I had friends, medical students, tell me that, and this was, you know, going back a bit now, I don't want to reveal how long ago, but it was quite a while ago, if they were organising a party, they would ring up the drug companies and the drug companies would provide... No, I'm serious.
Provide what?
Would provide the funding for the food and wine. That was what happened then. Nowadays, it's probably a little bit cleaner, but nevertheless, medical students are targeted from the beginning because it's about building long-term friendships between drug company staff, marketing people, and doctors. And so it's really from cradle to grave.
Ray Moynihan is my guest, investigative journalist who focuses on health issues. Ray Moynihan is here. His most recent book is called Sex, Lies and Pharmaceuticals. And two of his books are certainly about the preparedness, as he sees it, of major drug companies to create a climate of fear which encourages healthy people to take drugs they don't really need. Conferences. Doctors and medical researchers are obliged to go to conferences. That's a professional obligation so they can keep their professional knowledge up to date. What role do drug companies have in sponsoring some of these conferences, Ray?
Well, the vast majority of medical conferences that our doctors go to are sponsored in some way by drug companies. There is increasing concern and alarm within the medical establishment about that degree of influence, but it's certainly the case. And And you will say to me, well, they're just funding it, they're just sponsoring it, they're not having any influence over it, right? Well, again, excuse me, the evidence suggests that there is influence. Sorry about that.
You're right. You can have a sip of your cup of tea if you like.
Might,
right?
I might. But a couple of years ago, I broke quite a major story. We got a box full of documents from a company that ran just the sort of conferences you're talking about. And what we saw in great colourful detail in the email chain was the fact that companies, drug company sponsors of conferences, were having an input over who spoke at those conferences. They were helping to select the speakers. Not only that, they were helping to have a choice. They were helping to decide which topics were covered at the conferences. And more importantly, they were helping to shape the way in which the speakers framed discussions about the sponsors' drugs. This is nothing other than corruption. It happens regularly, and that was a couple of years ago. We broke that story at ABC Background Briefing, and the Australian newspaper ran it. The facts are all there, and it's a sad indictment of a medical profession that is still just too inebriated with that drug company money, because it's very easy to call up your drug company mates and to get them to help you put on a conference. It's much harder to find the independent money, the cleaner money.
Ray, in 2003 in the United States, Dr. Brian Brewer praised a new anti-cholesterol drug. Why was his endorsement so important?
Well, I think, excuse me, I think I'm remembering Brian Brewer as someone who had more financial relationships with drug companies than you could poke a stick at. I can't remember the exact number, but I seem to recall that he had a lot. Now, what you're raising here is the example of the so-called key opinion leader. These are the leading specialists in their particular specialty. And this happens in Australia all the time.
This guy had done research and he was widely admired.
Widely admired for his research on, you know, heart disease, cholesterol, so on. And these people often get up and endorse drugs implicitly, sometimes indirectly, in their interactions with other physicians. They are called key opinion leaders. They lead opinion. Now, as the reality is that many of those key opinion leaders have had their careers funded and fueled with drug company money. A lot of the research they've done, a lot of the meetings they go to, a lot of the trips they take are funded. And so when they write papers, they have to declare their financial ties. And sometimes the number of financial ties that these doctors have is just extraordinary. But I think one of the key things here is that our listeners today would not know if they're specialists were on these sorts of gravy trains, because currently, so far, at the moment, doctors do not have to disclose those conflicts of interest to their own patients. And I think that is a reform that the government could easily bring in. It's a form of transparency that's reasonable and rational, and indeed there are calls for that. But we only get to discover all these financial ties when people publish in the medical literature.
So this doctor endorsed a anti-cholesterol drug that was called Crestor, and that really was a breakthrough for the company.
Yeah, well, Crestor was a very controversial drug. It's a cholesterol drug. It's now one of the top selling drugs. It's selling all over the world, I believe, in Australia as well. But when it came on to the market, I believe in the 2000s, it was very controversial. There were calls from drug safety groups in the United States for it not to come onto the market because of issues about potential harms. So the endorsement from a senior person like that was very valuable. And indeed, this is how medicine, this is how the sometimes dirty business of medicine works. Drug companies pay specialists to help endorse their products, but those payments are often not visible to the public.
Let's talk about cholesterol drugs, because you use that as an example of where the patient pool has been widened hugely. A drug that may well be very helpful to some people is greatly broadened into people who don't really need it. That's what you say. I was really surprised to discover that Lipitor, which is a statin, is the world's biggest selling prescription drug of all time.
Mm.
This is a lot of people take a drug like that, or
they do.
A statin.
They do.
What is a statin for?
It's to reduce the risk of future heart attacks, strokes, that sort of thing. So it's prescribed for a condition called high cholesterol. But this is another one of the things that I've written about in Selling Sickness. There's a chapter on cholesterol in Selling Sickness. We've come to think that these things like high cholesterol are diseases in their own right. They're not. They're simply, if you've got elevated cholesterol, it just means you have a slightly higher risk for having a future heart attack down the track or a stroke. And the problem is that the thresholds that define what is high cholesterol keep being lowered, so much so that we have, well, in the United States, I think 40 million adult Americans are said to have high cholesterol that should be treated with drugs. The actual thresholds keep being lowered, so many, many of our listeners who are at very low risk of future events will have been told by their doctors that they have a worryingly high cholesterol and should be taking drugs like Lipitor. I think this is highly problematic. There needs to be much more discussion about this.
What about the research that was that produced the figures that said that so many Americans should be taking a high cholesterol drug?
Well, I think that one of the things I've drilled into. If you look at the panel of experts who set these thresholds, in the case of cholesterol, I think it was something like 7 of the 9 experts who were on the panel that said this is the cutoff. Above this, we must treat. 7 of the 9 experts all had multiple financial ties to the drug companies that make the cholesterol drugs. There is a giant scam going on in the way we define disease and define illness. It's not a conspiracy. It's just the way that medicine works. And the solution to it is to replace those panels of experts with people who do not have financial ties to the extent that the current experts do.
Ray Moynihan is my guest in conversation. Ray is the author, co-author of Selling Sickness, How Drug Companies Are Turning Us All Into Patients, and the co-author as well of Sex, Lies and Pharmaceuticals, How Drug Companies Are Bankrolling the Next Big Condition to Women. And we'll get onto that soon. So are you saying that high cholesterol isn't a major contributor to heart disease?
No, I'm not saying that. The question of the role of cholesterol in heart disease is a highly complex one. Again, it's very much more controversial than we think.
But there are other factors.
But there are many other factors. And I think what I am saying and other people are saying is that we are putting far too much emphasis on cholesterol, because the drug companies have helped convince us that that is the most worrying thing. And personally, I mean, it's funny we're talking about this, because I'm just about to do a sort of fairly major investigation for the British Medical Journal on exactly this question. How important is cholesterol really? And it may be that we look back in 10 or 20 years' time and just think, gee, we were hoodwinked. We had the wool pulled over our eyes. We took all those billions and billions and billions of dollars of Lipitor when most of us didn't really need to. Now, that's speculation, but certainly there's no question there is controversy over far too many healthy people taking these drugs, and there is far too much emphasis on it when there's a whole suite of other things that increases our risk. Sitting around all day the way we do, not exercising, the diets we have, the fact that we feel powerless in our lives. Increasingly, we're realizing that these things have an impact on whether or not we're going to have a heart attack.
There are public faces for public health initiatives and campaigns in the United States. There's one organization called the Boomer Coalition, directed right. at baby boomers. Who are the Boomer Coalition? And who's their public face?
You know, I can't remember who the public face was, but the Boomer Coalition, I mean, that was a classic example where, I think that the drug companies virtually created a front group that was to get out there and tell people to keep taking their drugs. And this is one of the things that we see in medicine too, that the what look like independent foundations and independent patient groups, if you start digging in and following the money, as one learnt at Four Corners, you find all sorts of nefarious things going on.
They're called AstroTurf groups, aren't they? Because they're fake grassroots organisations. They resemble kind of public charities in some ways, but they're not. They're not really, are they?
AstroTurfing. It's a beautiful concept.
Industry executives, I'm sure, would say they're merely getting people to come forward who would otherwise be undiagnosed and untreated. Because particularly with men, we know that men are reluctant to go into the doctor and say, I'm feeling this way. And that these organisations that they're funding are encouraging people to front up to the doctor and say, maybe you should have a look at this.
Yeah, you know, this idea of encouraging people to see their doctor, that's one of the key messages that those ads we were talking about before in America.
All, and here, there are ads now of that kind here.
See your doctor. You know, sometimes that is not the best thing to do. Sometimes it's better to say, don't just do something, stand there. really. And, you know, there's a new book out called Overdiagnosed. I've just read it. It's written by some Ivy League researchers from Dartmouth University. Utterly brilliant piece of work. And anyone who wants to see their doctor regularly should have a look at this book, Overdiagnosed, stunning book, and takes on this idea that the healthy people should regularly go for checkups and so on.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
My guest today is Ray Moynihan, health journalist. His book is called Selling Sickness, How Drug Companies Are Turning Us All Into Patients. And his more recent book is Sex, Lies and Pharmaceuticals. Ray, I just wonder how different it is with doctor culture in Australia and the United States. This is obviously something that's pretty widespread. I'm just trying to think of my own experience. I don't really see anything like the same kind of drug company paraphernalia in a GP's office like I certainly did when I was a kid in the 70s.
Yes, look, it is changing. That's a very important point, Richard, and we should say this, that there are a growing number of Australian doctors who are saying no to the free lunches, who are saying no to the pretty drug company reps, who are saying no to the trips away to Geneva for that special conference once a year. I think it's still a small number, and no one's got any stats on this, but I suspect it's still a small number, but a growing number. And in fact, whenever I talk, and I talk regularly around the world, there are always GPs or doctors in the audience who say, well, come on, make sure you mention us next time you talk about this issue. And it's a very important point. However, we do know that the evidence is there that the vast majority still go to the drug company-funded educational events, still go to these dinners. We know that there are 30,000 drug company dinners every year, or dinners and lunches and morning teas in Australia every year. We know that from the drug industry because they're forced to reveal it. 30,000. 10,000 of them take place in restaurants, and we know that for a fact.
What pressure do patients put on doctors to get a pill too? I'm just wondering about that. I know it's very difficult for doctors sometimes to have a patient show up. They've heard about it, or their friend is taking a medication for something. They've heard about this. They want a pill.
That's true, and that's another part of this conversation, that the concern about too many of us becoming patients, some of that is driven
By us.
We're doing it ourselves. And I think there's a fascinating, philosophical analysis of modern times. Why are so many of us so quickly turning to a medical explanation for our problems, for our distress, for our grieving, for our inactivity, for our obesity, our overweight? Why are we turning so quickly to medical explanations and medical treatments that may ultimately hurt us?
Can we talk about menopause now? Menopause is a great example of how what is an utterly and absolutely natural phase in a woman's life was somehow portrayed as, women suffering a deficiency. Tell me how that unfolded.
Richard, I think that's the first time a man has said to me, let's talk about menopause.
I know, because men just switch off. I certainly did too. I wasn't even aware about this, but as soon as I hear a kind of a discussion amongst women about menopause, I go, oh, I'm going to the bar. But reading this, I sort of tuned in
it's
for the first time.
It's fascinating, isn't it? It's fascinating. Yeah. In 1966, there was a best-selling book came out called Feminine Forever. And it described the menopause as a disease of estrogen deficiency. Now this was a bestseller.
My producer's mouth is wide open at this point. She's deeply shocked.
This was a bestseller.
Yeah.
And of course, the drug companies were involved. The medical profession were involved. We, all of us listening to this program now, have grown up at a time when the menopause was portrayed as some kind of medical illness. And that is one explanation for why so many women have been taking long-term drug treatment to treat their condition called menopause. Now, this is a complex issue. We're going to have people write in or complain about some of the simplicities in what I'm saying. But there's no question that menopause is a great example of the over-medicalization of life.
Drug companies in the United States presented hormone replacement therapy as a means by which a woman could overcome this deficiency.
Correct.
And retain her youth, womanliness.
Her youth and her womanliness. Yes. And in a way, you know, that was code for her sexuality as well. And the drugs were promoted really as a panacea for everything. They would reduce the risk of heart disease. They would, you know, keep your bones strong. They would keep you young and healthy. They would improve your sex life. And consequently, generations of women have taken them. But of course, the tragic end to this story comes at the beginning of the 2000s, where for the first time, there's actually a proper, good quality scientific study of what these drugs are doing to women. And what do we find? They're increasing their risk of heart attack and stroke and blood clots, increasing, and cancer. So generations of women were literally taking long-term hormone replacement therapy that was hurting them. It's an extraordinary story of modern medicine.
Yeah, I was talking about this with my wife last night, and she was talking, you know, with older people, and the thing that really struck her about it, she said, because I haven't been paying attention once again to this, that she had.
You've been
of course.
At the bar.
I've been at the bar. And she said the thing that really sort of rang a few alarm bells in her was the idea is that you'd keep taking this hormone replacement therapy
forever
until you were dead.
That's right. Now, this is another good example of the age that we are in now, where the notion of lifelong drug therapy has somehow become a normal idea. And so you don't just take them when you're sick and that's it, like antibiotics. You take them forever in order to stay healthy. Now, again, for some people who are at very, very high risk, let's say very high risk of a heart attack or very high risk of a fracture, possibly lifelong drug therapy may be appropriate. But this idea has been sold to millions and millions of healthy
people. It's
for
all women.
It's for all women, yes. and cholesterol drugs are for everyone. You know, we should put them in the drinking water. You know, there is a real problem here that we have become far too quickly do we jump at this idea of a long-term so-called preventive medicine. And I think there are many, many of us who probably can get on in our lives without this suite of long-term medicines. I mean, if you look at the medicine cabinet of your average elderly person, it's full of so many drugs. And we know from good, hard evidence that if someone, a rational doctor, comes in and looks at that suite of drugs, a huge proportion of them can be reduced and removed. You know, because every drug carries a side effect, no matter how good the marketing shtick is or how pretty the drug rep is, they all carry side effects.
Let's move on to the latest thing you've zeroed in on, female, so-called female sexual dysfunction. Now, there are elements of this which are are just appalling and make you sort of shake your head in other times make you burst out laughing, really. Yeah. Describe how this what this dysfunction is supposed to be.
Well,
really.
Look, it's hard to say because really so much of it is a marketing construct. But the technical definition of female sexual dysfunction is a disorder, people having disorders of desire or arousal or pain or orgasm. Now again, let's be clear here. For some women, there are very serious and severe sexual difficulties. Let's say, for example, women who've had nerve damage due to some sort of surgery. For those women, there's a real genuine medical problem that may need medical treatment.
It is listed in the psychiatric Bible, which is the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM.
Correct.
It's listed in there as
a genuine condition.
As a genuine condition.
Absolutely. And I think, for some small... But I should say those definitions are constantly changing.
Yeah.
There's so much controversy about it. But the real... The thing that got me interested in writing about this and led ultimately to sex lies and pharmaceuticals was this claim that 43% of women suffered from this condition.
43%. Now, last year, or was it the year before last, I had Bettina Arndt on the program. Bettina Arndt, who's written about low levels of desire, particularly amongst older women, and her solution isn't necessary to take a pill or therapy. It's just I'll have a go anyway and see
just
if you like it.
Just say yes.
Yes, but that need not be the case, according to drug companies.
Well, that's right. Look, I should say Bettina and I have various varying views on some of this stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure you do, yeah.
And it would be fascinating to get her and I in a room together and have a debate one day, because I think we have some divergent views on what's going on with sexuality. But let me say that in answer to your question, that the drug companies would make us believe that low desire or reduced desire or the difference in desire between men and women is due to some sort of chemical problem that can be fixed with medicine. And for about 10 years or more, particularly in the United States, but increasingly in Australia, you will see little articles popping up in the media that X percent of women have this condition of low desire or X percent have female sexual dysfunction, and there's a drug in the pipeline.
Though, when you say 43% of women have this, doesn't it then become not a dysfunction and kind of just the way it is? Isn't it? I mean...
Well, that's the common sense reaction to that 43%. And you know, really, it's sort of laughable when you hear those sort of figures.
Where was this claim published and who was making this claim? Is it a reputable journal, a reputable, I've got that in inverted commas, body of work?
Yeah. Well, the journal is reputable. It's JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. It published in 1999 an article that said 43% of women have female sexual dysfunction. What I did, of course, back in the early 2000s when I first got interested in this, was to go to the paper, read it in great detail, drill into it, talk to the people who did the research. And when you do all that, you realize that the study that was published shows nothing like that. It shows nothing like the fact that 43% of women have some medical condition. It shows that 43% of women occasionally have some questions or issues around their sexuality, that occasionally they lack interest in sex, or occasionally they feel a little bit uneasy about their performance, or they find it difficult to orgasm, or they orgasm too quickly, or, you know...
Their sex lives are vaguely disappointing to them, in other words. And that means they have female sexual dysfunction.
Well, that's right. That reaction is the one you get when you talk about this.
I think every woman listening to this is bursting out laughing at that.
Well, hopefully. But, I mean, the serious side here is if you look at the researchers, unfortunately, they did have financial relationships with the drug company who was trying at that time to get Viagra approved for women. And so that's the reaction to this.
Well, this is the search for pink Viagra, and they've never quite found it, have they? The drug companies haven't produced
They've had a go for 10 years. Well, Viagra was going to be the panacea for women. Then it was testosterone was going to be the answer. Then more recently, there was an old antidepressant.
That alarms men right off the get-go. You want to give women testosterone so they're going to feel like having sex more often? Well, why do we not want to have sex with these women who are taking all this testosterone?
Well, the other thing, I mean, the side effects of testosterone are rather unpleasant too.
Yes.
Leaving aside voice deepening, mm-hmm. facial hair and genital enlargement, there's also the risk of possible long-term increase in risks of cancer and heart disease.
Look, you mentioned that one of the drug companies. I went due to the magic of the internet, I found a little screener that they came up with. This is the decreased sexual desire screener, sponsored
like a
by
test,
a German,
like a diagnostic
like
test.
Like a diagnostic test, and this was one that was devised for non-professionals, so they could use this, and they said this matches up with 85% of the time of the more formal and professional diagnosis. It's worth reading, if only for make people laugh or shake their heads. Now, this is an honest-to-God questionnaire. And this is published in a public medical journal in the United States, and they said, this is terrific. That's what they said. Okay. The questionnaire includes the following questions. One, in the past, was your level of sexual desire / interest good and satisfying to you? Two, has there been a decrease in your level of sexual desire / interest? Are you bothered by your decreased level of sexual desire or interest? Would you like your level of sexual desire interest to increase? If a woman answers no to any of these questions, then she does not qualify for the diagnosis of generalized acquired, this is called hyposexual deficiency disorder. Okay, then they go on to say, that, well, are you taking medications? Are you pregnant? Have you had recent childbirth? Have you got other conditions, et cetera, et cetera? Answering no to all of the factors in question five would qualify for the diagnosis of generalized acquired HSDD, hyposexual disorder. Desire disorder, hypo meaning lower rather
than
hyper.
Right, okay. That's right.
And the conclusions from this public health assessment was, this is from a public journal, This screener is a sensitive and specific brief diagnostic instrument for generalized acquired hyposexual desire disorder in women that is quick and easy to use.
That's
terrific.
Right. That's right. Well,
are they crazy? I mean, that's just mad.
Well, it is. And so many women are going to say yes to all those things.
I know.
And they're going to end up with the diagnosis. And that's the point. This what you've just read out was a diagnostic tool designed in part by drug company employees. This is the other bizarre thing, that the drug companies, not just making the drug, now they're also making the test to see whether you need the drug or not. And that little screener, you know, the plans were to roll that out across the world in GP surgeries from Wagga Wagga to, you know, to Broome.
I suppose the assumption behind it all is that high and constant sexual desire is normal for
women.
Correct.
That's the insidious message here. And you know, okay, some men might appreciate that message.
I know, but if women felt the same way, no one would get any work done, would they? Right?
and look, humour is a very powerful strategy here. And in fact, one of the characters in Sex, Lies and Pharmaceuticals, Dr. Leonor Tiefer, an academic from New York, has a wicked sense of humour. And she casts a lot of questioning and doubt over a lot of this marketing by using humour. She's the one who famously said, "Not tonight, dear. The dog ate my testosterone patch."
So I suppose then what you're saying is, with this, I'm just putting this to you. Then really, it's not a case of if they can't ever come up with a treatment for it. It's more like Viagra. It's not really to treat a disease. It's a sex aid, really, isn't it?
That is
something
that
you might want
right,
to take
Richard.
Once a month or something, or
well, that's
once a week. Or
what's happening is a sex aid, a potential sex aid, is being presented to the world as if it was a cure for
an
illness.
A medicine.
Correct.
Yes.
And they need to make it look like a medicine in order to get it approved by the regulatory authorities and then market the hell out of it. If they just came along to the authorities and said, we've got a sex aid we want to market, this pill, then they'd be told to go home. And so that's what's happening here. Essentially, you're right. I think there's a giant con where what are really potential sex aids are marketed as if they were medical treatments. The caveat there, of course, is that for some people they may well be beneficial as a medical treatment. And the other important point is that these are not very good sex aids. If you look at the side effects of Viagra or their testosterone or more recently an antidepressant that they were trying to market, these are not good sex aids.
What about a bottle of really good champagne instead?
Well, people say that may help.
Dinner, you know, that kind of thing. Tell me how shyness became social anxiety disorder, and there's a pill for that too, isn't there?
Well,
I mean, this is. I don't want to laugh at this too much because this is true. Some people feel painfully shy and they're called upon to do public speaking. They may take a medication that may help them with that. Just tell me your thoughts on that.
Yes, and even worse, Richard, for some people, social anxiety disorder is a real genuine psychiatric problem that requires some sort of help. But the numbers suffering from that condition are tiny. In Australia, there was a campaign, a drug company came up with a campaign to market this condition here. And I remember seeing the press release and it said 1 million Australians suffer from this condition. I'm serious. I've probably still got it in my box of archives. In Australia, it was called social phobia rather than social anxiety disorder. And I rang the managing director of this company in Australia, and I said, what's going on? And he said, oh, yeah, look, on the record, he said, oh, the marketing people, they often like to beat things up a bit. And that campaign totally failed. It backfired because it was just too ludicrous. But in the United States, of course, a much bigger market where you can market your drugs direct to consumers every day, the campaign was a huge success. And one of the biggest PR companies in the world was used to work with the drug companies to reposition shyness as if it was the symptom of a disease. And it worked. A lot of drugs were moved.
You mentioned the diagnosis of ADD and attention deficit disorder and ADHD earlier on in this hour, Ray. I'm staggered to note that a report last year from the Australian New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry said that prescriptions of Ritalin, the drug to treat ADD and ADHD, has tripled in 7 years. Tripled. It's increased 300% in just 7 years.
Mm.
I suppose that the people behind these drugs and would be saying that we're treating a lot of kids who would otherwise be undiagnosed.
Yeah.
People undiagnosed.
This is a complex one, but it's, you know, there is increasing alarm about the numbers of young Australians,
boys
mainly, but boys and girls, who are being labelled with this condition potentially unnecessarily and then are being treated, again, with long-term, essentially what are amphetamine-like substances. There is growing alarm about this here and in America. There was a conference just a few days ago in Brisbane on this. Look, it is complex. I think probably at the severe end of the spectrum, there's probably a group of kids for whom this label may be helpful and treatments may be helpful. There's, of course, other treatments other than drugs. But I don't think there's any question that vast swathes of healthy children are being wrongly diagnosed for a whole lot of complex social and psychological reasons. Bear in mind that amphetamines have a history of being quite useful. Race horses are given amphetamines to make them race better. Probably dogs are too. These things can increase our concentration and our performance, and that's why they're so connected with the educational endeavour, and people take them to improve performance. So again, I think what we're seeing, as with Viagra and so on, is this the new sort of lifestyle drugs. Drugs that aren't used to treat illnesses, but are used to sort of improve and reduce inconvenience and that kind of thing. And what's worrying is that the harms of these things are often glossed over. We really don't know yet what the long-term use of amphetamines does to a five-year-old's brain. We just don't know. There is some science on this. There's speculation. There's questions. There's some research. But any parent who does that is really putting their child into a long-term uncontrolled experiment.
I wonder how much of this again comes down to what goes on in the doctor's surgery, in the room with the GP. On the one hand, you mentioned the parents who, in that child you mentioned earlier on, who seemed to be implying that some pill ought to be given to their kid. That was something that was happening at the... Or if parents are sceptical, I don't suppose there are too many who feel intellectually confident enough to question some of the assumptions behind these prescriptions in that room. It's always going to be an imperfect interaction, isn't it, in that doctor's surgery?
It is unbalanced. They call it asymmetry. Yeah. It's unbalanced. The knowledge and power and information that resides in the doctor is much greater than the patient. But that relationship is changing. It's becoming much more equal, and so it should.
Is the internet helping in that sense, or is it doing more damage?
It's helping, but it's also hindering, because there's so much rubbish on the internet, and so many of the sites that look like they give you value information are actually sponsored by the drug companies or other vested interests. But this point you raise is an important one about how hard it is to question your doctor. I mean, I had another book, 10 Questions You Must Ask Your Doctor, which is really how to take a more questioning approach. But it's not easy to ask your doctor, well, how often do you receive drug company money? And how well have you studied the literature behind the drug you're about to prescribe to me? But I think this lack of questioning and this sort of intimidation also affects journalists. We haven't talked about this, maybe another year, but a lot of our media coverage of medicine is really misleading promotion, because too many journalists are intimidated by the doctors and the professors and the scientists.
I certainly know, even in the ABC, you get a media release, and you really have to look at it very, very carefully. You have to say, well, they'll bring some research with this really interesting little factoid at the top of it, which will spark a discussion with listeners, all that kind of thing. And you have to look at it very, very carefully. And there's a number, and you have to call, and you really have to ask a whole series of questions. Is this being sponsored by a drug corporation? Is this being sponsored by a food corporation?
And it's often not that easy to find out.
No, because it might be a breakfast program, and so you got something fun to run with, you can just run with it.
That's right. And unfortunately, I have to say that I would encourage listeners to be extremely sceptical about any health information they hear, including on the ABC. You know, I think that the ABC patches of coverage of medicine and health on the ABC are good, and other patches are extremely poor. And I say this as someone who's actually studied the way the media covers medicine. I published on this in the New England Journal of Medicine, in fact. And we know from good evidence, partly from my own research, that a lot of medical stories in the media are simply misleading. They over-exaggerate the benefits of the product, and they downplay the harms.
Sure, it's the old turnaround. Oh, it turns out coffee's bad for you. Oh, it turns out coffee's good for you. Oh, it turns out it's bad for you.
Yeah,
red wine's good, red wine's bad.
All of that.
That all flips around.
Yeah.
Just finally, I've only left you a couple of minutes to do this, Ray, unfortunately, but what about the role of the watchdogs? In the United States, it's the Food and Drug Administration. In Australia, it's the Therapeutic Goods Administration. They take their cue from the FDA. What's the firewall like around them in terms of the influence of drug company money and research?
Well, that's a very good question, and you won't believe this, but but the regulator is funded by the drug companies. And you're looking at me blankly, and that is how it happens, through user pays fees. So if I'm a drug company and I come to the Australian regulator and I want my drug approved, I pay a fee for that assessment. So in a sense, well, not in a sense, the regulators are funded by the industries whose products are being assessed. This has been a huge controversy in the United States with the FDA, which again has a large amount of its money coming from the industry. So for the regulator, who is the client? Is the company the client, or is it the public and the taxpayer? It's a big question, and again, it's a question for another day, but there are question marks over the independence of the regulators. There are so many drugs on the market that get so heavily promoted before they are rigorously examined, and we've had too many examples of drugs being pulled off the market, and some people argue the regulators should just be a little bit tougher.
Ray, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.